From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, as teenagers, they marched for housing reforms. Now, 50 years later, they share those memories.
Later, as school begins, we'll recap the week in education with our Rachel Morello.
An architect talks about the disconnect cabin owners are seeking.
They may not feel that they need TV screens or computer screens, for that matter. I know when I go to my cabin, we kind of allude to the fact that there are no screens in our cabin. There are to keep the bugs out, but not the other kind of screens.
Plus, we'll take a road trip to northern Wisconsin and a couple of summer camps that have been part of one family for decades.
As long as I can remember, we were jumping in swamps and bogs and seeing what's out in the woods and around campgrounds that we can use for various activities.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. This week marks the 50th anniversary of the historic push for open housing in Milwaukee. On August 28, 1967, marchers began their demonstration. They continued for 200 consecutive days, in some cases encountering violent counter-protesters.
Reports about that period often focus on the charismatic leaders of the push for open housing. They included Father James Groppi, members of the NAACP Youth Council, and Vel Phillips, the alderwoman who had been trying to convince the Common Council to approve open housing for years.
But in this segment, we hear from some of the lesser-known people involved in the marches. WUWM's Annalise Henzel compiled reflections from some of the marchers, people who were teenagers at the time.
Father James Groppi of St. Boniface Church was the advisor of the NAACP Youth Council. The Catholic priest and teenagers on the council are pictured walking side by side in countless photos of the housing marches. But the group didn't form with the intent of becoming political. That's according to Dr. Shirley R. Barry Dirge, who was a member. She shares this origin story.
The youth didn't have anything, nowhere to go for entertainment, just to sit and have a soda and talk. So Father suggested that why don't we all just meet after church in the church basement and we can just talk and talk about, you know, our schools or whatever was going on in the community, whatever our concerns were. And actually, that's what was the birth of the Youth Council.
It was toward the end of 1966 that the Youth Council began pushing for open housing, an end to discrimination against Black residents. For months, the council and Father Groppi used a number of tactics to pressure city leaders. Then, in August of 1967, they planned a symbolic march across the Menominee Valley, walking to the near south side, which was largely white.
The first march across the bridge was terrifying, and they were throwing glass, bottles, cans, rocks, and stones.
Dirge is talking about the walk across the 16th Street Viaduct that spans the valley. When marchers got to the south side, they faced the wrath of counter-demonstrators who easily outnumbered them. That was the first of 200 consecutive nights of marching. And Dirge says it wasn't the only time the marchers faced danger. The Youth Council formed a group called the Commandos, who were tasked with protecting the marchers. Yet they couldn't keep everyone safe. Dirge says a lot of her friends were injured over the course of the marches. So was Father Groppi. She was walking near him when he was hit by a big rock.
And blood just came all down his face. And the commandos immediately surrounded him, put him further in the middle. But Father didn't faze him at all. He just kept marching.
I don't think anybody quite expected it to be as intense.
Barbara David Salas was another marcher. She says not only were people surprised by the intensity of the pushback, they also were surprised the marches went on for so long.
At the beginning, the preparation was not for a 200-day march. It started with the large marches. There was lots of reaction. National attention focused on Milwaukee. There were people from all over the country who joined us here for those marches initially. But it didn't accomplish what we wanted. You know, even with all that attention, even with all that pressure. So I think we all felt that we weren't going to give up.
Sala says the push for open housing wasn't just about ending the discrimination African-Americans faced. She says it was a movement for justice for everyone. And she says in the thick of the confrontations with counter-demonstrators, the issue of race faded away among the marchers.
Facing a screaming mob, throwing things at you, do you think we worried about which one of us was black and which one of us was white? We were brothers and sisters in the cause.
Dr. Earl Bracey was another member of the NAACP Youth Council. He says the marches grew out of frustration among African Americans who had moved from the South to Milwaukee to find work. Bracey says many expected to find more opportunities, including the freedom to choose where they lived.
I think in the South, a lot of the racism and discrimination was kind of overt. You know, in the North, it was more covert. So people would do things and they would do it to maybe contain or to kind of keep you back from progressing, you know, not being able to buy a house, you know, where you wanted to buy a house. You know, and some people, they're kind of like cordoned off.
Another marcher, Ken McGee, says black residents only were welcomed in a small portion of the central city. He says people selling houses in other neighborhoods could turn away African Americans who were looking to buy a home there.
You probably had some real estate brokers who were African-American who also steered you away, assuming you're not going to be happy there, so they didn't even show you houses. That was my issue. I should, if I can afford it, I should be able to live where I want to live.
In the early spring of 1968, Congress was considering the Fair Housing Act. The Youth Council ended its nightly marches. Less than a week later, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. A huge march in his honor took place in Milwaukee. And not long afterward, the federal government and the Milwaukee Common Council approved open housing laws. Although several factors contributed to the end of legal housing discrimination here, McGee says there's no denying the role the Youth Council played.
We forced the city to recognize that it was an issue because we marched every day.
For Lake Effect, I'm Annalise Henzel, 89.7 WUWM.
Audio for this story was collected by journalism students at Marquette University.
WUWM education reporter Rachel Morello joins us after a break to talk about the week that was in education, just as kids are going back to school. Lake Effect continues in a moment on WUWM.
Now, as I get to school, I hear the late bell ringing. Running through the hall, I hear the glee club singing. Get to the office, I can hardly speak, cause it's the third late pass that I got this week. So to my first class, I run and don't walk. All I hear is my sneakers and the scratching of chalk. And when I get to the room...
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today is Friday, but believe it or not, it marks the first day of school for many students around the Milwaukee area. Some have been in class, of course, for a few weeks, and others go back after the Labor Day weekend.
Unlike some, or most kids in the area, education reporter Rachel Morello eagerly awaits this day all summer long. Because as the new school year begins, there are plenty of classrooms to visit and stories to tell.
And Rachel joins me in the studio now to give us the scoop on what's going on this week in the world of education. Hey there, Rachel.
Hey, Mitch. Happy New Year.
New school year.
New school year.
All right.
Okay, Mitch. So rather than just run through the headlines, I actually thought it would be fun if we turned it into a little quiz, see how much you know about what's going on. You down?
All right.
Okay. All right. So here's your first question. The state's budget writing joint finance committee finally approved a dollar amount to commit to K-12 schools this week. Was that amount higher, lower, or the same as what Governor Walker had originally said he wanted to go towards schools?
Ooh, tough one. I will say the same.
It was actually lower. Way back in February when the governor gave his State of the State speech, he made it a point to say education was going to be one of his priorities this budget cycle. The governor has been touring the state the past several months, touting what he called a record $649 million increase in the amount of money the state puts towards K-12 schools. And this week, the Budget Writing Committee approved a slightly smaller amount, $639 million. So they cut about $10 million from Walker's original request. I reported out a full story about the vote, so you can find more details about that on our website.
It's funny. We're having this conversation. It's September 1st. It's kind of late in the year for the legislature to be talking about budgets.
Yeah, usually they try to approve it by early summer, and their goal this go-around was actually to be done by July. But you might have heard of a little thing called Foxconn. The state's deal with that tech giant took up a lot of the legislature's time the past few weeks. So they're just wrapping up their regular business now as schools are already starting the new year, like we mentioned before.
So other than money, anything else that lawmakers have to tie up related to schools?
Yeah, there are a few interesting proposals still on the table. Lawmakers are talking about creating a curriculum for firearm education, so essentially gun safety classes for high school students. The classes would be optional. Districts aren't required to put them in place. Some already do, particularly districts in areas with active hunting populations and sport shooting teams. Most of those districts who have those in place right now coordinate with outside organizations to create curriculum. But if this proposal passes, the State Department of Public Instruction would have to create a streamlined curriculum for schools to use in terms of how they're educating students around guns. We're on to question number two. So are you ready for your next question?
I am.
Okay, this one is a fill in the blank. This fall marks the second year for blank, an initiative out of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee to help boost achievement at some of the lower performing Catholic schools in Milwaukee. Do you remember the name?
On the tip of my tongue, but I am not going to get it.
Okay, Seton Catholic Schools. You might remember, and our listeners might remember, that this is a network based out of the Archdiocese that basically centralizes administrative duties for lower performing Catholic schools in Milwaukee. They started with about 9 schools in their network, and now they've added 4 more to that list. And one of those schools is Catholic East. I spoke with the principal there, Jennifer Jones. She told me she's excited to see what being part of Seton can do for her school. They found some pretty significant achievement gaps. And so over the last semester, they've worked with Seton to redo their reading curriculum and their math curriculum. And here's what she said to me about what she's excited to do with Seton.
The biggest thing is that it's a network and that we're all here to work together. Teachers have an opportunity to work with other teachers from different schools. It's not this big, scary system that's happening. I think there's a lot of positive movement and it's centered around our Catholic values as well as a broader picture of having success for all students in the city of Milwaukee.
All right, Mitch, so unfortunately, you're 0-2, but you have a chance to redeem yourself. Are you ready for question number 3?
I hope I get Carl Castle's voice on my answering machine.
Okay, so I'm going to play you a sound clip, actually, for this one. You have to name the person who's speaking. This is a local politician who recently completed a fellowship that helps elected policymakers develop a better understanding of education policy.
Right now, Milwaukee County has a relationship with MPS, and we already do provide some services. I think there's more we could do.
And so my job is identify that politician?
Yes.
That is Chris Abley.
Ding, ding, ding. Correct. Okay, so the county exec just completed 9 months of work under the Hunt Kane Leadership Education Policy Fellowship. Super long name. Basically, what he did is he was nominated to be part of a group of national, it was attorneys general and state senators and some people on county levels like him. They attended sessions with national speakers like the former Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, and visited school sites around the country. County Exec Abley mentioned that he went to South Carolina to see some schools out there. And they were learning how they can work in their different leadership roles to improve education for students in their area. The county exec said he wants to learn more about how he can work to expand and deliver wraparound services for Milwaukee students and families. That's something he's mentioned before. Things like healthcare and housing services and job training. So here's a little more of what Abley said about the experience of being part of the fellowship, specifically how he worked with the other state leaders that he met. Okay, nice job, Mitch. You got one right.
Thanks. And does Chris Abley get a nice certificate to put on his wall?
I don't know about a certificate, but he is now part of a network, so he gets to be part of, you know, a group of people who he can keep in contact with as he moves forward.
There's quite a range of experience in education policy among the fellows when they come in. I made a lot of good friends, and as important as anything, you know, I've got a lot of counterparts with whom I feel very comfortable bouncing ideas off of and, you know, giving open and honest feedback. And that's always a privilege.
So this little education quiz with Rachel is going to be a regular feature on Lake Effect every so often. We'll look forward to seeing you back in this very studio soon.
Rachel Morello is WUWM's education reporter. You can find her stories on our website, where Rachel is also trying something new. You can now submit questions you have about schools and learning in southeastern Wisconsin. Anything you'd be interested in hearing Rachel cover, just find the question module at WUWM.com/education.
We'll talk about what sets cabins apart from any other kind of structure, both the architecture and the state of mind, when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Depending on where you live in the United States, you might describe your weekend getaway differently. Here in Wisconsin, you might head up to your cottage, or maybe it's your cabin. That's how people in Minnesota generally refer to it. In the Northeast, places like Maine and the Adirondacks, people talk about going to their camp.
Whatever you call it, that place of retreat comes with a certain state of mind and often a certain architecture. Both of those aspects are of particular interest to writer and architect Dale Mulfinger. Mulfinger has designed cabins that are now along lakes and in the woods in Wisconsin and Minnesota. He's also author of the new book, The Family Cabin, and he joins us on the line from his office in Minneapolis. Welcome to the show.
Great, Mitch. It's good to be here and happy to chat about cabins, one of my favorite subjects.
So when you look at the cabins in this book, they are all different shapes and sizes, and they're situated in different places. What holds cabins together under the definition of cabin in your eyes?
A couple things. I think one is they tend to be in places that attract us even before we put a structure on them. So whether they're at the water's edge or on a mountaintop or looking out over a broad prairie, they tend to be in somewhere that we want to go to. And then after that, they tend to be a structure that, even if it's larger in scale, tends to focus on the common areas. Because in a cabin, we're not going to spend much time in our bedroom. We're going to spend time with people or we'll be outdoors. So they are places where bonding can occur and is promoted. And you might be sleeping on the couch in a cabin as opposed to in a bedroom. Or they have lofts because we want to be able to hear the people who are still chatting away downstairs as we go to bed at night. So they definitely permeate a certain kind of character about them.
There's a certain state of mind that goes into it.
Very much so. When you go to the cabin, often feel as though you're getting away from something, whatever that might mean for you, getting away from your hectic life or the life that you might have in your professional world and where you live in the suburbs of the city. And so you're trying to get to this other place where all of a sudden hearing the loons every night takes you, in a direction that wasn't the case when you were in the city.
As I was getting ready for this interview, I was jotting down some notes, and the idea of, having your real personality come out when you're at a place like a cabin was one of the things I put down on paper.
I think that certainly a different part of you comes out. Which one of them is real, I don't know. But, whether you're out fishing or hiking or stargazing at night because all of a sudden you can see the stars because you're not in the city lights, all of those things bring out a different side of who you are and what interests you. And you might have, if you go with people to their cabin, you might have never known that they were, in addition to being the person you knew, they're also a hunter or a trekker or something in that life they have at the cabin.
So as an architect and as an architect who designs cabins, how does the process of working with someone to design a space like this differ from how you might approach other projects?
Well, I, as an architect, do projects for people in the city and whether that be an additional remodeling or a new home, and then also do cabins in sites that are here in the Midwest. They're commonly found on lakes or rivers. And when we do those projects, I think one of the notable differences is that most people who have an extra dollar to build a place at the water's edge will often think of that as a legacy project. That is to say, they're not going to make their decisions based on resale. They're going to make their decisions based on they expect that their child is likely to inherit that, or children are likely to inherit that. So they're able and willing to put more personality into the structure than they would at their house in the city. So in the house in the city, they're going to every so often say, well, is that going to resell? And they rarely ever say that for their cabin location. So that's a big difference. So the other difference is they're not going to put so much emphasis on sleeping spaces. Yes, they need a place to sleep. Yes, they might want some privacy there, but they're not going to dwell in a bedroom. They're going to dwell in the common areas of the cabin.
I was really struck by, you mentioned this, the loft designs in some of the cabins in this book, the idea being that they're apart from the common areas, but they're sort of connected to them enough that you still feel, you know, especially if you're a child going to bed upstairs in the loft, that you're connected with the stuff that's going on downstairs.
Yes, we have a loft in our cabin, and we thought initially, it's quite a small loft. We thought initially when children went to sleep up there, they would have a hard time falling asleep with us chatting down below them. And what we found is they actually fall asleep much quicker in a loft than they do if you store them away in a bedroom and close the door, where they might have some fear or who knows why it is. But hearing the calm banter of adults actually helps them fall asleep. So I think there is a sense of connectedness, of intimacy in a cabin that's important. And even, we think of possibly sleeping in the same bedroom as other adults, and we don't think too much of that in a cabin. We just accept the fact that it occurs. I have taught for quite a bit at the University of Minnesota, and I often say that the cabin is the only place I've ever slept with my dean, and I slept in a loft, and his wife and my wife were in the middle of the bed, and he and I were on the outer edges of the bed. And you know, you do that at a cabin, you'd never think of doing that even in a motel room.
There are a number of cabins in this book that are off the grid, and I imagine the owners of these places are very much on the grid in their day-to-day life. How do you balance, you know, designing a place that has modern amenities with the idea that it ought not to be just like the house that a cabin owner has left behind?
A lot of people want to downscale the technologies. When they get to a cabin, they want a more primitive sense of their existence there, so they may not feel that they need TV screens or computer screens, for that matter. I know when I go to my cabin, we kind of allude to the fact that there are no screens in our cabin. There are to keep the bugs out, but not the other kind of screens. And I think people like getting away from that interconnectedness with everything. I often enjoy the fact that I really don't pay too much attention to the news when I'm at the cabin, although I do often turn on the radio to hear the news, but I don't have a television there, and I don't miss it. So I think people enjoy that, and some people are more significantly off-grid in the sense that they're not connected to an electrical system that is a collective system anyway. They may have a few solar panels to drive something. Most people will still have some form of, say, gas appliance, whether that be a gas refrigerator, gas stove. There are not too many that go totally, totally off-grid and disconnect themselves from both gas and electricity.
I know you have written specifically about tiny cabins in the past. This book has a little of everything scale-wise, but I did want to ask you how the world of cabin design has been influenced by this tiny home movement that we're hearing a lot about.
Well, I think the design of cabins arrived at the tiny house movement long before the tiny house movement, and people were building very small cabins and enjoying them. So my first cabin was 14 by 18. And with a little tiny loft, and I wasn't alone. There are certainly other people who have done structures like that. So the tiny house movement is probably a name that really attracts people right now, and it's fascinating. But I think we could learn a lot. The tiny house movement can learn a lot from cabins that have been built for the last 100 years.
There's a cabin in this book for which I think you were the architect up in the Boundary Waters, and I don't know how many square feet it was, but I was just amazed at the use of space.
Now, that cabin is 14 by 27, and then it's got a little additional front entry area and a screen porch in addition to that. So, and then it does have two lofts, one on either end of the gable structure. So I don't know what that totally adds up to in square footage, but probably less than 500 square feet. And yet it serves a family of five.
Wow. There's also a section of this book that features cabins that draw on history, either by repurposing a historic structure from the site or by design that harkens back to historic structures. In some cases, I was looking at this and thinking it's interesting to consider how, you know, say the settlers in a place who built a log cabin out of necessity might view it being used as a getaway.
Yes, I suspect that many of those settlers would be surprised today at our romance and charm of historic log structures. often those early settlement or settler rather log structures were actually thought to be rather primitive structure even by the users of it, and eventually wanted to clad them over in clapboard or whatever. Today they're being uncovered and repurposed as cabins in the woods, such as the one that I feature that's in the Mark Twain Forest in Missouri. And of course, new structures are being made to emulate older historic structures. One of the older structure types that I've been fascinated with now for a number of years and have featured in a few books that I've done is what I call the porch cabin. It was a cabin back in the turn of the previous century that featured about two-thirds to three-quarters of the cabin was itself screen porch, and then there was a little warm room in the middle if you needed to escape from the cool fresh air. And I believe that the rationale for those cabins historically was that it was intended to take the family out into the rural area for the summer to be in fresh air to ward off those nasty diseases of polio and diphtheria that were plaguing the nation at the time. Over time, those have been retained, or in a few cases, some of them have been filled in a bit as people no longer go to their cabin for the whole of a summer. We have had a few clients here at Saul Architects that have asked, can we have a contemporary screen porch cabin? So we've created a few new ones, they've been a lot of fun to do.
How do you view climate control? Because, I mean, I know spending time in a cabin every summer, one of the beauties of it is that by the end of even, you know, within a couple of days, we sort of lose the ability to tell what's inside and outside. I mean, being sort of really part of the atmosphere and the feeling of the natural environment. And it seems like looking at many of the cabins in this book, that's also a key part of the equation.
I think so. We often do want to add a bit of heat into our cabins for those really cool evenings and or cooler subsets of even the summer season. But we don't necessarily need to add air conditioning because we really enjoy the fresh air. And so maybe a few ceiling fans are all we need for when it gets a little too hot. And people really don't want to shut out the noises, whether that, in your case, it might have been the noise of the waves of the ocean lapping against the shore, or in the case of inland lakes like we have here in the Midwest, the sound of the loons at night. You don't want to really miss that, so you don't want to really shut that world off. You want to hear the rain in the trees and the sound of the leaves clapping or something in the breeze. I think even if we're indoors and out of the bugs, we want to be able to be connected to the sense of fresh air, the smell of the pine trees and so forth.
So how did this happen to become your specialty? Why did you become a cabinologist versus an officeologist or a ballparkologist or what have you?
Well, I was already working in the sub-industry of residential home design. So then I got a client who asked me to do a cabin, and I realized I didn't know a lot about cabins because I had grown up on a dairy farm. We worked 365 days a year, and we didn't have any time to run off the cabins. So I realized I needed to know something more about it, so I started to research the subject of cabins here in Minnesota and in Wisconsin. And I did that at first with some students, and we were asking the question of, if you went out and saw 10 cabins, which one would feel like it was the quintessential cabin compared to the others, and why? And so if you do that enough times, you begin to gain a feeling of what seems to be the attributes of a cabin. Along the way, then I started writing for local magazines on the subject of cabins, and that led me to a lot of interesting subset questions about how were cabins built. You know, what's the difference between a vertical log cabin and a horizontal log cabin? And the porch cabin came out of that research, and so forth. So I think I just was fascinated by the subject, and then the other part of it I realized is that nobody was doing it. You know, I was the only one out there sort of trying to uncover these things, and I didn't have a lot of competitors doing it. And so I just kind of filled a void that turned out to be helpful to my professional life.
Does your interaction with clients differ when you're working with them on a cabin versus just a house?
not dramatically. a lot of the issues are similar. I mean, you're trying to sort out, as a designer, you're trying to make sure that what you're creating for your client is what they want and what they understand. Not every client reads drawings, or, you know, we build a lot of models and today do a lot of computer modeling in order to show clients what they're getting. So I'd say the process isn't dramatically different. I think it's important to be for we designers to be out on the site a lot, because a lot of what we're going to do has to do with the fact that we're fitting it into a unique topography, that the lake view is in the westerly direction, and the sun comes up over here, and the entry is going to be over there. So there's a lot to be learned from being at the site. I think also there's a different set of builders to work with that are out in cabin land. They may be builders who make sure they get 2 weeks off to go hunting every fall. And there may just be other things about the nature of who's out there. And then there are different products available to us or not available to us out in cabin land. So some of the more nuanced, new, sophisticated products may not be available. On the other hand, local trees are being milled, and you can have them made into paneling uniquely for each bedroom in your cabin. So, there are some nuanced differences when it comes to creating a cabin.
Is this a busier time of year for you? Are there people at the end of the summer who really start thinking about the cabin that they want next year?
That's somewhat true. People will come back from their summer at the cabin and be fresh with ideas of wanting the XYZ change before they get back there in the spring. But the other phenomena that has been occurring over the last probably 20 years is that fewer and fewer people are thinking about their cabin for just summer use. They're beginning to think of their cabin throughout the year. So we're doing almost, I would say, 95% of the cabins we do today are really intended for four-season use. So they're well-insulated, can be used in the middle of the winter. We have to think about, are we heating them all the time or totally shutting them down? But generally, it's heating them all year, but, you know, turning the heat down to make sure the pipes don't freeze. So I think that's related to the fact that we no longer, as a society, commonly think of taking 3 weeks off in the summer. Our mom and the kids don't get to go to the cabin for the whole of the summer, but rather we take snippets of time off all year long. And for many of us who have cabins, who use them in the winter, we really enjoy being there in the winter, the quietness of it all, and getting out to cross country ski or do other winter sports.
Well, Dale Mulfinger, I think you have you've really whet my appetite anyway. Thank you so much.
Sure, Mitch, come on over and see some of our Minnesota cabins.
Dale Mulfinger is Principal Emeritus at Sala Architects in Minnesota and author of several books on cabins and cabin design, including his latest, The Family Cabin, Inspiration for Camps, Cottages, and Cabins. He joined us on the line from Minnesota.
When one Wisconsin family talks about the family camp, they mean it quite literally. We'll explain when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Hello, mother. Hello, father. Here I am at Camp Granada. Camp is very entertaining. And they say we'll have some fun if it stops raining.
More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Before the break, we talked about getaways to the family cabin. For one Wisconsin family, they've been getting away to their place in the woods for decades, but they've been sharing that time with hundreds of people.
Earlier this summer, Lake Effect's Susan Benz traveled about 250 miles north of Milwaukee to a place where one family has offered generations of kids their vision of a hands-on nature experience for over 70 years.
Welcome first to Towering Pines Camp for Boys.
Welcome, girls, to Lake Nokomis.
A cluster of teens and preteens huddles on the pier along Lake Nokomis' northeastern shore. The girls are paying a special visit to compete in a camp ritual, the Dread Pirate Regatta. Will Dellinger divides the sailors into teams.
On the escape, Diego, Ross, and Tommy.
Growing up, Will's summers and that of his siblings meant camp. This season, the 23-year-old was counselor to a cabin full of 15 and 16-year-olds, and as you can hear, he was managing the camp's sailing program. Will's brother Jonathan is second in command at Towering Pines. He's old enough to remember their grandfather, John Jordan, the camp's creator.
I spent a lot of time riding around with Grandpa, even though he couldn't walk all that much at that point.
John Jordan's story was extraordinary. At age 18, the Illinois native visited this area for the first time with his girlfriend. Somehow he convinced his dad to invest in this property, selling their house to cover the down payment. John suggested starting a fishing resort, but his dad prevailed, and in 1945 they opened the boys' camp.
As long as I can remember, we were jumping in swamps and bogs, looking at pitcher plants, and seeing what's out in the woods and around campgrounds that we can use for various activities. And it all kind of intertwines.
John Jordan had polio, but never let it slow him down. It wasn't until late in life he gave in to motoring around the camp in a golf cart. It's those drives Jonathan cherishes, along with his grandfather's writings.
He took notes and he wrote in memoirs. I think he recorded a lot for posterity, but he never tried to really write a book or anything like that. But we still, we know much of what we know about camp because of the things that he wrote down, his records, his diaries, and his memoirs. And we try to carry on a lot of those as best we can.
As famished campers clamor into the dining hall, Jonathan's uncle, Jeff Jordan, shows me around. He's a high school physics teacher, but he's been running the camp for 30 years.
I originally thought I was going to be a chemical engineer, but then quickly figured out that that wasn't going to work too well if I wanted to come up here in the summer. So just like my dad, who was a fifth grade teacher.
Full disclosure, this reporter never spent summers at camp, not a one. So I may be romanticizing the atmosphere here. On one hand, young life permeates the air, while at the same time, the camp oozes history. Jordan pulls out a 1974 edition of National Geographic. That's the year Towering Pines was featured, resplendent with photos of kids lying shoulder to shoulder on the forest floor and getting a sense for the natural world from a raccoon's point of view. The program, called Acclimatization, aims to immerse the campers in the natural world.
There was a man by the name of Steve Van Meter, who was, if you look him up, he's very well known in ecology. He's kind of a guru, and he worked here for a number of years and developed this acclimatization program. And he wrote a book, which is a bestseller. Most camps will have it somewhere. Mm-hmm. The culminating activity is getting a block of soil, asking the kids to dissect it, so to speak, and then ask them to put it back together. And they realize, well, there's no way to put that back together.
2 miles due east on their own sand lake at Sister Camp Woodland, a group of girls have a good swim on their minds. The Jordan clan took it over in 1970. Growing up, this was one of Calla Craze's favorite activities. She's Jeff Jordan's niece and Will and Jonathan's sister. These days,
I teach swim lessons in the morning, and I'm like, oh, I would not trade my mornings at this Woodland waterfront for anything.
She not only teaches swimming, but also horseback riding. In between, Calla squeezes in coordinating all of the girls' camp programs. It may not surprise you, Calla echoes her brother's words. Camp set her life's course.
So I teach sixth grade math and science. Camp is why I became a teacher, you know, because when I became a counselor when I was 17, I just really loved it, and I was like, oh, all right, I want to teach.
The lines between school year and summer camp appear to blur.
The growth, it's just so awesome to watch. They show up, and they're nervous, and they've never been away from home before, and they're meeting all these new people, and they're trying all these new things, and by the end of the summer, they're like, oh, no, I'm staying here forever. You cannot take me home. And they're, like, masters at all of their activities. It's just awesome to see.
There are more family members entrenched in the camps you haven't met. For instance, Calla's mom keeps the books balanced and manages the kitchens at both camps. Her aunt directs the girls' camp. Matt Dellinger admits to feeling just a wee bit jealous of his sister, brothers, and other relatives. He too grew up at Towering Pines and savored summers as camp counselor. But today his work and growing family only allow him sporadic camp visits from his home in the Milwaukee area. We walk a fraction of the 500 acres his family stewards.
We go from the older forest into the younger forest, and it'll become more bright and colored with leaves and sun coming through leaves. That transitions up here a bit. You'll notice that the horses come through with the girls, so they get a nice ride through here.
It's clear Matt and his family take their legacy to heart.
It takes a long time for these ecosystems to be put together the way that they are. But it only takes a moment to just disturb all of that. And if you want to see that masterpiece again, you're going to have to wait a few thousand years. Around here, maybe.
Matt thinks back to his last conversation with his grandfather, camp founder John Jordan.
He said you retire when you die. And that's pretty much, he went to the last minute.
Did he?
Yeah, and I mean, a week before he died, he and I were sitting in his at his house strategizing what, you know, how to keep the camp stable for the future.
Matt's son, Emmerich, simply assumes his dad will figure that out. The five, now six-year-old, already has a list of camp favorites.
I've done sailing. I've done tennis. I've done horse riding. And what? I also did archery. And I did riflery.
So what's your favorite thing when you come here?
Riflery.
Emmerich's words would be music to his great-grandfather's ears. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
I tried a chipmunk and a different one.
And you hit the target once, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty good.
Towering Pines Camp for Boys and Camp Woodland for Girls are located in northern Wisconsin, not far from Eagle River. You'll find pictures from both at WUWM.com.
Before our next segment, here's a few seconds from comedian and honorary Milwaukeean Jim Gaffigan.
I went camping recently for this next joke, and I married a woman who loves to camp, and I am what you would call indoorsy. I'm surprised we can still get people to camp. Hey, want to burn a couple of vacation days sleeping on the ground outside? No.
What if There's I told not you much more we need to say, except here's Lake Effect essayist Megan Schultz.
We've never done this before. My husband said to me with obvious reluctance. Why don't we just try one night and see how it goes? I agreed because I wanted him to be happy and I really wanted to do this, but I knew how it would turn out with only one night. I knew that setting up a tent and blowing up air mattresses and putting together a camp kitchen in the dry 90-degree Central California heat only to take it all back down in less than 24 hours was a ridiculous idea. But he was hedging his bets, saving his campground, free card, just in case. It all seems rather foreboding now. Did he know that our three-year-old would throw up all over himself and every possible crevice of the car seat minutes after the last bag had been packed in the rental and we were about to hit the road? Or that our five-year-old would spike 102 fever the night before? Did he know that the lake would be stricken with blue-green algae or that the sign at the park entrance would read, "Dogs and infants are advised to keep out of the water"? Did he know that the lifeguards would shout through the megaphone that no floaties were allowed in the lake on weekends just minutes after we'd finished up the life-size manta ray? Did he know that the tent my dad borrowed from his friends for our family of four would come without instructions because they'd lost them on their honeymoon back in 1979, the last time they set the damn thing up? Did he know that our three-year-old would later break out in a terrible rash from the natural sunscreen I bought at Whole Foods? Or was it the dairy, or maybe the gluten? And that he would have to leave dinner and drive 20 minutes back to town for a bottle of children's Zyrtec? I know, all that was terrible. But, I'd like to ask him, wasn't it fun to wake up in each other's arms because we'd sunk to the middle of the mattress overnight? When was the last time we got that close in our king-size bed where we lay continents apart, divided by an ocean of pillows? And wasn't it fun to watch our boys play with sticks and hunt for frogs and stare in wonderment at a beetle the size of their hands? Didn't he love watching the joy on their faces when they squeezed marshmallows and chocolate between two graham crackers? Or when they looked up to see the first star in the sky overhead? All the things we never do in our city life. If I ever do this again, it's because I love you and I know it means a lot to you, he said to me as we were leaving the campground after breakfast, an hour before the official checkout time. I know he was not in his favorite element, that he doesn't like to be dirty or hot or tired. I know he'd prefer a hotel pool and a tab at the bar because he works 60 hours a week and doesn't want to spend his weekends sweating over manual labor. But sometimes I miss the zone just beyond comfort, the one that directly correlates fear with fun and risk with reward. I hope we don't forget about that zone as we settle into middle age, or raise kids who play it safe while their curiosities are wiped out like the dinosaurs who tower in the stale museum air. We definitely made some memories, he said, as we rehashed the camping trip back at my parents' house on their firm guest bed beneath crisp white sheets. Maybe we can get a bigger tent and the boys and I can try sleeping in the backyard this summer. The lights were out, so he couldn't see me smile. Attaboy, I thought. Attaboy.
Megan Schultz is a mother and writer living on the east side of Milwaukee with her husband and two young boys.
If heading for the campground isn't your thing, we revisit some timeless ideas for keeping kids occupied on Labor Day weekend when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The calendar might point to September 22nd as the first day of fall, but anyone with kids knows that Monday, Labor Day, feels like the end of summer.
The three-day weekend looms ahead, and that can be a challenge for parents who worry they've exhausted all their ideas and maybe all their spending cash over the past couple of months.
Contributor Stacey Tornio joined us last Labor Day weekend with a few ideas you might want to dust off to keep your kids, your grandkids, or yourself occupied. And at the risk of sounding so 2016, we thought we'd revisit them this year. Hey, Stacey.
Hey, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
It's good to see you, and I asked you what's going on because we're going to talk about some things that might be going on, especially if, you know, you're kind of challenged. It's like, well, we've done Discovery World. We've gone down to the lake. We've done this. We've done that. What can you do with the young people in your life on a summer day when you might not have anything going on or you might just have 2 hours to kill?
And you don't want to spend a lot of money because I'm telling you, it's easy to entertain kids if you have money. But then sometimes you're like, I just like go and do something for and that doesn't cost a lot. So sprinkler, number one, like this is like everyone can think about running through a sprinkler in the summer. And it really like it doesn't cost any money. You throw it in the backyard and you just like let them go.
You don't need a lot of room. You just, yeah.
Nope. Yep. And it related to that is water balloons. So that too, like sometimes you'll definitely spend more time filling up the balloons than throwing them. But like, who cares? That'll keep those kids busy.
I will say a huge milestone in the lives of the little tykes at my house is when they both got to the point where they were old enough to tie their own balloons.
Oh, that is huge. Like, if you can teach your child that life skill, then kudos to you.
Like, next stop, driver's license.
Exactly.
All right. So, sprinkler, water balloons, what else can you cook up?
So, how about a scavenger hunt? And I have two ideas, actually. Scavenger hunt and an obstacle course. So, both of these are, like, using the imagination. So, you know, let the kids, you know, write out clues for each other. Like, they're going on a treasure hunt and have something, you know, a little prize at the end. An obstacle course. So, this is my daughter's idea. And she says, oh, Mom, you just, you know, you set up chairs and you set up benches. Like, in our backyard, we had a little flower pot and a golf ball. And so you actually have to go through each station and we time the kids to, you know, see how long it takes them. And that is really just their imagination.
And the nice thing about the obstacle course idea is it's also something you can do inside in a pinch.
Yeah. So if it's really hot and you just can't stand the heat, like do that inside as well.
All right. Other ideas. You had the thought about kickball and really I know there's some adult kickball leagues out, but when was the last time you played kickball?
Yeah, and like, again, focusing on that, you don't need a lot of resources. You don't need a lot of money. Think about all it is a playground ball, and really you can have fun. Like, the adults can join in. It can just be a kid's game, whatever.
Same idea. I had an opportunity. I was with three kids not long ago, and we played Foursquare.
Oh, see? That's the same thing. And all it is a ball and sidewalk chalk, actually. That's the next on my list. So Foursquare, you can create your own Foursquare board using sidewalk chalk. Otherwise, you know, chalk is really inexpensive, and you can have a lot of fun with that as well.
And if you've got a basketball court in your driveway, sidewalk chalk, also you can set up an around-the-world course.
Oh, yeah. See? Imagination. That's what the kids, they just challenge them.
I'll admit I hate sidewalk chalk.
No, it's
all
awesome.
Over my hands, man.
Oh, come on, Mitch.
There's a good way to get rid of the sidewalk chalk in your life if you are like me, and that is a toy exchange.
Yeah, so gather up, you know, maybe your sister or someone in the neighborhood and do a toy swap. It doesn't cost any money at all. You know, the kids can discover each other's toys, you know, do a trade, set a schedule like once a week, trade a toy. So it keeps it kind of fun and promotes sharing.
These are all ideas that really involve no money at all. What about just a little bit of money?
Okay, so here's another idea that my kids and I do. So we will do what we call like the dollar store challenge. And so everybody gets like $1 or $2, like keep it really, really cheap. And we go and everybody like kind of secretly picks something out. And this is, again, where that imagination comes into play. And it's like pick something out that we can do as an activity and we can all do it together and it can be really fun. And so everyone's kind of hunting and trying to find that perfect thing. And then we all take turns and we do each other's idea.
Have any examples of things that have come out of that?
Yeah, so actually at the dollar store, one of the ideas on my list is like making popsicles. Like you can get a popsicle mold at the dollar store and then you can make your own popsicles all summer. You can, you know, experiment. You can throw some fruit in there. You can just do the Kool-Aid popsicles. So that's a great activity and an idea that really just cost a dollar.
And it's especially good if you like having your kids drop by the refrigerator every 15 minutes to see if they're frozen yet.
Right, exactly.
All sorts of ideas to have fun. And the best part is some of these things, even if you don't have kids, they would be fun.
Yeah, exactly. Get a kickball and challenge your friends, like your 20-something, 30-something, 50-something-year-olds to a kickball game. I promise you'll have fun.
And after you're done, run in the sprinkler.
Exactly. I love it.
Stacy, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch.
Lake Effect contributor Stacy Tornio is author of numerous books for kids and their parents about nature and runs the website destinationnature.com. You can find links to some of the places we talked about at wuwm.com. And that's Friday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Joy and I are among the producers of this fine show, along with Bonnie North, Audrey Nowakowski, and Mayan Silver. We get additional reporting from Rachel Morello, Susan Bentz, and Aisha Turner.
Plus, we get web and social media support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering from Jason Reavy. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.
Them for sure themselves. Them for sure. Opposite people. Them for sure. Everyone did.